Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It was easy to do and hard to ignore. I'm John Schaefer, and all this week on Soundcheck, we're going to be talking about dance crazes, and we'll kick off our series with a look at one of the most sensational moves in dance history, the twist. Plus, how televised dance parties help teach Americans how to get down. Later.
Oh, I guess I just wasn't made for these times.
Singer Kat Edmondson might remind you of a bygone era. Her voice has drawn comparisons to Billie Holiday, and her new album features this reworking of a Beach Boys favorite. We'll hear some of the songs from that record called Way Down Low when Kat Edmondson and her band play live in our studio. All of that on Soundcheck after the news. And since you're listening to a podcast, you don't have to listen to the news. But before we actually get to the body of the show, I want to ask you a favor. Tell us what you think of the Soundcheck podcast. What do you like? What don't you like? Your opinion counts, and we want to keep making the best podcast we can. So send us an email, soundcheck@wnyc.org. All right, that's soundcheck@wnyc.org. And now, on with the show. In the land of a thousand dances, one reigns supreme. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today we begin a week-long series on dance crazes, and we'll kick off with the twist. Plus, we'll examine television's role in dance fads with the host of a modern-day TV dance show, and a live performance from singer Kat Edmondson and her band. But first, the twist. Chubby Checker once described it as drying off with a towel while putting out a cigarette with both feet. Sounds peculiar, but it apparently made sense to pretty much everyone back in the early 60s. Even in the pre-digital age, the twist spread like wildfire. And joining me now on the phone from Spain is dance historian and critic Sally Summer. Sally, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
So teaching there, is that what has you in Spain these days?
Yes, I teach for a couple of months.
Now, recently, the death of Dick Clark here in the States got people talking about the old American Bandstand TV show and the leg up that that gave to The Twist and to Chubby Checker. Give us the real kind of roots of where this dance craze came from.
Oh, my goodness, the roots of The Twist probably go back to when the first Africans started arriving in the New World.
Okay, maybe don't go all the way back then. Let's start in the 50s. What was going on then?
Okay. Well, during the 50s, I mean, it was the Eisenhower era, and, you know, people were young white teenagers were conservative. They were going to what were called hops. Sock hops, and the kinds of dances that they were doing were rather sweet, closed couple position dances, some open position dances.
What's an open position dance?
An open position is when they are not holding each other, and they are dancing apart, but together. And the twist was not the first time people had danced apart, although that is one of the things that is often talked about, that, oh, the twist was the first one where they danced apart. Not really. Mm-hmm. They danced apart when they did the Charleston, too. But what the dance offered to these young white kids was it offered them the opportunity to move their hips and to move their hips in a way that was acceptable. And it spread like wildfire, I think, because it had that edge of, you know, slightly being ever so slightly naughty and being, you know, the latest craze. And if you did the twist, you were really with it. You were hip. The twist was a dance that, of course, Chubby Checker's brought to popularity, although the twist originated with Hank Ballard and the Midnighters.
Right.
And so, Pardon me?
That was back in 1959, right? The original Hank Ballard recording, which actually, funnily enough, it wasn't the A side of the single. It was the B side, but it was the one that DJs were drawn to, and it became a modest hit for Hank Ballard.
Come on, baby. Come on, baby, let's do the twist. Take me by my little hand and go like this.
Now, that's the original recording of The Twist by Hank Ballard. It was the B-side of a single released in 1959, peaked at number 16 on Billboard's R&B chart, and we're speaking with Sally Summer, dance historian and critic, on the line, talking about The Twist and why it was important and why it was such a big success. So, Sally, it wasn't such a big success first time out of the box, but where did Hank Ballard get it from?
I think Hank, he's a wonderful songwriter, and he was a wonderful, also watched the floor. Mm. And that's really important for good singers and performers, is to watch the floor. And I actually asked him whether or not he saw the kids doing, that kind of twist stuff on the floor. And he said, yeah.
Now,
band was doing it, too. I mean, I saw an old clip of them, and sure enough, there they are. They're up there twisting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for him to, make a song for it was a very natural and organic kind of evolution of what was going on with him and his band and the kids that he was playing for at the time.
And was he playing for a white crowd, a black crowd, mixed?
No, I think primarily he was playing for a black teenage crowd.
Uh-huh.
But I don't really know. But I think that is, primarily they were probably black kids. Although there was a lot of mixing with black and white kids back there that is not written down in history.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was occurring. And I think that it didn't become a hit because it wasn't pushed by somebody like Dick Clark.
Right. Now, of course, 1960 comes along. Chubby Checker has a number one hit with his version of The Twist after he introduces it on Dick Clark's American Bandstand.
Yeah, you should see my little sister. You should see. She knows how to twist.
Chubby Checker, The Twist from 1960. There's a great, great video of Chubby Checker doing The Twist on Dick Clark's American Bandstand. Check it out. It's on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. So, Sally, was Chubby Checker somehow a safer bet for white kids to sort of adopt this movement?
Oh, yes, and he was a much safer bet for Dick Clark. Because, he has that innocent little face. He's got that kind of childlike quality that makes him not threatening. He also was light-skinned, and mm-hmm. Hank was very dark. Hank was a grown-up man and looked like a grown-up man.
This is Hank Ballard,
and
yeah.
Chubby, I think always looked very, very young.
Mm-hmm.
Even when he was in his 60s, he looked very, very young.
Now,
and I think
how about
that having him sell the song was brilliant Dick Clark's part.
Now, he makes it kind of socially acceptable. I mean, you talked before about, moving the hips and how, you know, especially for mm-hmm. white kids, this was not something that they had done before. This is all happening around the same time as Elvis, right? Elvis the Pelvis. He's shaking his hips. And
yes.
How big a deal is this in American society at the beginning of the 60s?
Huge. It's just huge. I consider it to be one of the major movement metaphors for the teenager moving more towards adulthood and less towards childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a watershed, actually, in the evolution of American popular dance forms. And because it spread, it's not that it was brand new, but it spread so quickly and so mm-hmm. wide, and it became a worldwide fad, and it became okay for middle-class white teenagers to shake it.
And it's how long was it before the middle-class white teenagers' parents started shaking it?
Pretty quickly.
That's pretty amazing, isn't it?
What's really interesting is that this is a multi-generational dance.
Right.
And it is, I don't know of another dance since then that has had that kind of multi-generational popularity, because whether you were 75 or you were 5, you were doing the twist. And it was even done at some, you know, very proper charity balls and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it crossed class, it crossed race, it crossed age barriers. And as I said, I don't know of another dance that did that to that degree.
Is it because of the simplicity of the dance? I mean, it's simply...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because essentially you plant your feet and you twist your knees,
right.
And your knees twist your hips. And
and you throw your arms out to keep from falling over, and there's your dance.
That's it.
We're speaking with Sally Summer. She's on the line with us from Spain, dance historian and critic. And Sally, what does it also say about the rise of kind of, you know, the power of teen culture at this time?
I think that it was during that period, you know, in the 50s is when everybody began to look at teenagehood as both a commodity and a consumer group.
Mm.
And they were recognized as this terrific force in, you know, American society. And it had everything to do, I think, with the giving that push that particular dance needed in order to spread wide and spread fast. Of course, television helped push it like mad, too. Everything came together at the same time. The recognition of teenhood, television, this easy-to-do dance, snappy music. I mean, everybody can sing the song. And it became iconic, actually. And if you want to, you know, rouse the image of late 50s and early 60s, all you have to do is just start doing the twist.
Which people started doing again. And this is the amazing thing, is how quickly the people around Chubby Checker cottoned on to the fact that, you know, just because they had a hit single, it wasn't enough. They needed to have a second hit single. So Chubby Checker released a follow-up called Let's Twist Again. And that hit number one on the charts for the second time in 1962.
My little sister, you should see.
So you heard a little bit of Chubby Checker's original, The Twist, and then Let's Twist Again. I mean, Sally, it's arguably an even better song than the original, but clearly meant to try and keep that wave cresting, right?
They tried forever to keep the wave cresting, and indeed it did crest for a very long time. That dance was immensely popular. And, of course, it spread around the world, and it spread very quickly. Once again, because of television, because of all the beach blanket movies that were made at the time. And it was a dance that also gave rise to a lot of other dances that followed it because of the little pantomimes that you would do with the hands when you were doing the twist. And the twist was also refined and used by the incredible Charlie Atkins, who was the dance teacher for Motown. And he's the one that gave them class, he gave them elegance, he gave them those sweet little steps that, you know, they just walk away from the microphone and then, bap, they get right there, right on beat again. And everybody was doing those movements. And I think Charlie gave it an edge of refinement.
Mm-hmm. And so it becomes a part of the arsenal of the performer, the singers,
yes,
the backup singers.
Yes, and it's done on stage. It's done off stage. So its spread and breadth was really, really amazing.
Mm-hmm. Now it still looms large in our sort of common cultural memory, but also in the specific memories of some of our Soundcheck listeners. Let me read you some of the comments that are coming in. These are pretty good. Jerry from New Jersey writes, "My wife dislocated her knee while doing the twist as a teenager. What a walk down memory lane." Jerry also adds, "The video of Chubby Checker is priceless." Ruth from Manhattan writes, "I am twisting right now and I can't stop." And Tom from the Upper West Side writes this, "Fifth grade, St. Bonaventure School, Columbus, Nebraska." Tom has a very dramatic way of writing, apparently. "Al Woodworth gave our first ever dance party on a Saturday afternoon. His high schooler sister and her friend chaperoned, with the basement decorated to be our own peppermint lounge. We twisted, we ached, we then hat danced and hokey pokied, and then we twisted some more." Tom mentions Peppermint Lounge. That's another part of the story here. Tell us a little bit about how that comes into play.
Well, the Peppermint Lounge was a place that attracted celebrities. It attracted politicians. It attracted teenagers who weren't supposed to go there. It attracted tourists. Mm-hmm. It attracted people who go dancing. In other words, again, that same sort of cross-section.
This is in New York, I should say.
Yeah. It was in the 50s, I believe. And it was someplace that was the place to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
And it epitomized, as I say, that kind of broad spread where anybody and everybody came to do the twist and watch the twist. And there was a famous dancer there. I don't remember her name, but she was one of the girls who danced there. And supposedly her fringe, that she wore one of those fringed dresses, mm-hmm. and her fringe was clocked at 90 miles an hour. I think that's apocryphal.
Yeah, we didn't have jugs guns then. You know, we weren't like measuring pitchers, fastballs, and things like that. But it's still a great story. Now, I mean, the Peppermint Lounge...
it proves...
Go ahead.
Speed.
Yeah. Now, the Peppermint Lounge house band, Joey D and the Starlighters, capitalized on what was going on in the club there, the whole twist craze, by recording their own song. It sold over 1 million copies in 1961, and it's called Peppermint Twist. Joey D and the Starlighters. They were the house band at the Peppermint Lounge, which was on West 45th Street in Manhattan, and which was a place to see and be seen, and people, even the reclusive Greta Garbo apparently was there watching people do the twist. You had people like Noel Coward and Marilyn Monroe doing the twist on the dance, a tiny dance floor, I'm told, there at the Peppermint Lounge. So the twist very quickly becomes a national phenomenon, a global phenomenon. And Sally, in a week where we're going to be talking about a lot of dance fads that come, hit big, and fade away, why has the twist never faded away? Why, when I go to a wedding, do I still see 5-year-olds and 75-year-olds doing the twist?
I think because if you listen to that music, it is so upbeat. It is so danceable, and the dance is so easy to do, and it's something you never forget because you can do it. And actually, the Peppermint Lounge, it's okay that they didn't have a big dance floor because essentially you stand in one place.
Right.
You don't travel. And I think that it definitely has to do with the music and the way it becomes embedded in the brain, but also it has to do with the way that dance becomes embedded in the muscles.
Right, and the way that dance becomes embedded in a lot of the popular songs of the 60s, even the Beatles got into the act. In their 1964 debut LP, they do a version of Twist and Shout. We've been speaking with Sally Summer, dance historian and critic, on the line with us from Spain. Sally, a real pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for being with us. In a moment, we've alluded to it already a little bit, but we'll take a direct look at the role TV played in the history of dance fads with the host of a modern-day TV dance party. And then later, a live performance from singer Kat Edmondson. This is Soundcheck.
Taking her hand to cross the street was as natural a thing as he'd ever done.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now in our week-long look at dance crazes. American Bandstand and Soul Train, whose theme you're hearing in the background, were two of the best-known dance party shows to hit the airwaves, but they were hardly the only ones. Joining me now from Chicago is Jake Austin. He's a TV producer and co-host of Chicagogo, cable access dance show in Chicago. And Jake is also author of the book TV a Go-Go. Jake, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks, John. How are you?
Good. So shows like American Bandstand, Soul Train, and lots of regional shows that never went national, how important were they in kind of propelling these dance fads on us?
Well, the thing was these dances would be regional, and a lot of them wouldn't leave the region unless people could see them. So they were very important. I mean, especially, you know, when you talk about the twist, that would have been a popular dance, but, you know, Dick Clark engineered, I mean, he invented a person, Chubby Checker, to make the twist popular. I mean, he sponsored the twist on television. But, you know, if you go to the 70s, Don Cornelius talked about how, you know, black dances that were regional wouldn't be on TV, and everyone around the country danced differently. And Soul Train started in Chicago in 1970, and Chicago had a very smooth, cool dance style that everybody did. And when Don Cornelius moved the show to L.A. in 1971, he was kind of shocked that people were dancing with all these, you know, staccato rhythms. And when that show went on, everybody in the country started dancing like that, and the local Soul Train in Chicago stayed on. But if you look at Soul Train from like 73 or 74 in Chicago, they're doing the exact same dances as the L.A. people, even though there had been, you know, 25 years of teenagers dancing a specific way in Chicago. the influence of Soul Train showing these L.A. regional dances made everyone in the country start dancing like that.
So was there still room for kind of regional things that, you know, would be popular, say, in Baltimore or Philadelphia and nowhere else?
Well, there always has been, but sometimes they aren't things that will translate, you know, to a dance show or to a fad that everyone can do. In the 60s, the reason you're getting a lot of these dances that become fads that really catch on is you're doing a lot of very easy dances. There was a children's dance show in Chicago called Kitty Agogo, and the reason they started that show was they realized that any five-year-old could do the Freddy or the Popeye or the Monkey. You know, they could just call these dances out. And a dance like that is very easy to catch on.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are styles in different cities. I mean, there still are. In Chicago, there's a regional style called juking, but it's incredibly difficult to do. So you can't just get anybody to do that anywhere, you know. So there's always going to be regional things, but not the same way in the 60s where you had these incredibly easy dances that everybody could do.
All right. Jake Austin is co-host of Chicagogo, which is kind of, you know, taking off from Kitty-a-Go-Go, the show he mentioned from the 60s. And here's a bit of that late 60s show. It's a dance floor of kids, and they're grooving even as the show begins.
And now here she is, the girl who makes the scene every week on Kitty-a-Go-Go, Pandora!
Hello out there, Kitty-a-Go-Goers! Are you all ready to twist and shout?
Yeah!
Oh, wonderful, because once again we're going to be doing the duck, the Popeye, the jerk, and all your favorites just like your big brothers and sisters. And that's not all. I've got a big surprise for you. Today, right here in person on Kitty-a-Go-Go, we're having the New Colony Sibs!
Which apparently is a band from Chicago, Jake Austin.
That's correct.
So that was Kitty-a-Go-Go from the 60s. You are now producing and co-hosting Chicago-Go, which looks like Chicago-Go on Chicago Cable Access. Where did you get the idea to sort of resurrect the dance floor as TV show?
From seeing those videos of Kitty-a-Go-Go was really kind of a revelation. You know, I've always been a huge fan of dance shows, and my wife and I, you know, we always watch them. You know, when we were in high school, we would get together and watch them, and it's something that we've always loved. And the idea of doing it didn't really come about till we got to see those videos, in part because you see these kids dancing, you know, with just abandon and being just so amazing and doing these, you know, simple dance moves that look so great when kids do it. Looks even better than when teenagers do it. But also because you so rarely get to see footage of live TV from the 60s. And watching those shows, the real beauty of it was that mistakes were okay and it could be shoddy and the jokes didn't have to be perfect and you just let it be. The real thing about seeing those videos that made it seem possible to do it was knowing it didn't have to be perfect, that you could just do whatever you do and kind of let the magic of live TV, you know, happen.
Right. Now, there's lots of dance on TV these days, but it tends to be big produced network things like Dancing with the Stars or So You Think You Can Dance and stuff like that. You're talking about something very different, aren't you?
It is very different, although, I mean, one thing about not Dancing with the Stars, but So You Think You Can Dance and America's Got Talent, it does have, they do have a lot of these little kid groups that are just doing, you know, that met in school or in a rec center. I mean, there will be little groups just doing what kids have always done, you know, got together and tried to learn a dance, you know, like cheerleading or something. So there is still an element of, you know, young people just wanting to move and practice and be good and look cool on TV. I mean, that's still there, but, yeah, it's very different from a dance show. I mean, one of the things that happens when you watch a dance show is that if you are watching a dance show and you dance at the same time, you know, that breaks down the fourth wall. I mean, it invites you to be a part of it. When you watch a dance show, it's regular people dancing, and then you're dancing with them. if you so choose.
Right. Now, your show, we have a clip from Chicagogo on our website at wnyc.org/soundcheck, and it actually features the well-known band OK Go on Chicagogo. So how does that work? Are they kind of lip-syncing and they're up there sort of performing and dancing along with the audience?
Well, see, they are lip-syncing, and that's one of the nice things about having our show. You know, we have a couple guests come on every week and lip-sync. And because contemporary lip-sync, what's nice about, you know, it's not when they have that opportunity, it gives them a lot of freedom. And OK Go is kind of the best example we ever had, because this was a local band. Since on and lip-sync, they decided to be creative and create a synchronized dance routine, you know, kind of as a joke. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they got they ended up doing a tour with NPR, or pardon me, not with NPR, with This American Life, you know, as the band that would lip sync during their, you know, national tour. And that led them to get signed to Capitol. And then when they were going to get dropped, they decided to do the synchronized dance moves again, that, you know, the idea that they first came up mm-hmm. with Chicagogo. So, I mean, we didn't help them get signed because it wasn't our creativity, but we gave them a forum to use this creativity, which ended up being something that they ended up drawing upon again and again and again, and it helped them, you know.
So lots of dances still happening on the floor of the various TV shows, including Jake Austin's Chicagogo there in Chicago on cable access. And one of the more recent dance crazes to hit the show, singer Cupid's Cupid Shuffle, which you're hearing in the background. Jake Austin is author of TV Agogo and co-host of Chicagogo. Jake, thanks for speaking with us today.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Jim.
This is Soundcheck. And up next, can't promise any dancing, but lots of live music from singer Kat Edmondson and her band. This is Soundcheck.
Don't believe in Paris or spring, and I don't wait for rings.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In 2002, American Idol took singer Kat Edmondson to Hollywood. Then they sent her home. And for some, that might have been where the story ended. But for Kat, that was just the beginning. She sang some high-visibility duets with Lyle Lovett, performed at the Tanglewood Jazz Festival, and now she's put out a brand new album all on her own. In a moment, we'll hear more about that, but first, here's a live performance. Kat Edmondson and her band with Champagne live on Soundcheck.
I'm never gonna drink again. At least not with the finer men. Oh, well, at a celebration, offering libations from the Appalachian, I couldn't resist one little kiss. But now the backache thrill is gone. I didn't mean to lead you on. My heart was not the one behind this amatory crime. No champagne does it every time. Thank you. off key. When bubbles get a hold of me, yeah, taking the equation of the fermentation and a cool persuasion, I got no hope. I'm such a dope NYC historiography. You'll find me under Fancy Free. I can't be held accountable. My word's not worth a dime when champagne does it every time. Oh yeah, well when champagne does it, woo, bubbles do it. When champagne does it every time.
That is singer and songwriter Kat Edmondson with her band and a song called Champagne, which appears on her new album called Way Down Low. Kat Edmondson singing. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, John. Thank you for having me back.
You and your band. Let me introduce them. Brian Wolfe behind the drums, Danton Bowler playing the bass, Al Street on guitar, Frank LoCrosto playing the keyboards. And Champagne is your own song, but man, that sounds like you could have plucked that out of the 1930s or 40s.
Well, that's what I was going for.
Were you, is this the song, you said, you told someone somewhere that you were trying to write like Cole Porter.
Yeah, I wanted to write a really cute and clever and sophisticated song. And the topic of champagne is certainly somewhat sophisticated.
Yes, very sophisticated. Yeah. And how many people have at one point or another said your opening line, I'm never going to drink again.
And I was swearing off alcohol that morning, actually.
Did it take?
Well, that's all I need to say, I suppose.
Well, it is a very kind of Cole Porter-esque beginning. I'm never going to drink again. At least not with these people at this time
right.
In that place. I have my standards, basically.
Right.
these songs, a lot of people listening to this album, this band, will assume that a lot of these are covers from that time period. How is it that, you, a young person in the early 21st century, have sort of gravitated to that sound?
It's the music that I heard first. When I was a little girl, I watched a lot of old musicals and learned this repertoire at a very early age. And so it was my foundation. And I tell people, just as a child learns a language and is immersed in a language, it became a part of me.
Mm-hmm.
And so it comes out very naturally.
But were you also listening, while you were watching these old movies on tape or TV, were you also hearing like rock and hip hop and stuff like that on the radio?
Yes, not as much early on. I really did listen. If anything was more contemporary, it was like 50s and 60s, rock and roll and doo-wop and stuff. I wasn't listening to newer music until I was probably 6 years old, and I started getting into Madonna. But I only listened to that with my friends. At home, it was strictly this kind of music. And so.
And where was home? Houston?
Houston, Texas, yeah.
Now, the album title, Way Down Low, where did that, again, that sounds like it could be 100 or 150 years old. Where does it come from?
Well, it's actually a lyric in this song, I Don't Know, that is a cover. I got the song off of a Willie Bobo album, who's a percussionist from the 60s. And actually, I think it might be 1970. I'm not sure. I'd have to check that. Anyway, it's a fantastic album, and this song popped up on the album that I just happened to be listening to, and I heard it and was really stuck on that song. Ended up recording it twice on Way Down Low, and and trying to find a name for the album, and that just rung out one day after 9 months of trying to figure out what the name would be. And so there you have it.
Yeah. Now, you have done some really interesting covers, not just here on the record, but last time you were here on Soundcheck, you were doing your version of George Gershwin's Summertime,
mm-hmm.
completely sort of reinventing the musical accompaniment, you know, while mm-hmm. while the words were obviously recognizably the same. How do you find your way into some of these old songs and make them yours?
Oh, well, first off, I really wouldn't do them if I couldn't make them my own. That's just my intention, is to present something new. Although I have nothing against somebody just taking an arrangement and singing it, because all of this is born out of the appreciation for the song in the first place. And making it my taking time and really exploring what the song in itself and the melody and the lyrics, what they mean to me personally. And that usually lends itself to whatever arrangement I end up coming up with. But oftentimes I'm also collaborating with other people to come up with the arrangements.
Mm-hmm. Now, with your own songs, I mean, this next song, Lucky, done with this group in mind or a similar group, or you just write the song and see what happens in the studio?
The night that I wrote that song, I co-wrote it with a guy named Kevin Lovejoy, who produced my first album, Take to the Sky, and we really didn't have any instrumentation beyond a piano mm-hmm. or a keyboard, actually, because that's all we had to work with at the time, and we were just trying to demo it on Pro Tools at home. And so Pro Tools, which is like a recording
it's a digital software. Music software, yeah.
And so that's all we had in mind for that. Most of the time when I write, I hear a melody and I hear the lyrics at the same time I start writing, and oftentimes I'll hear production, but never do I write with an instrument, really.
Hmm. All right, well, let's hear how the band handles this version of Lucky, a song by my guest Kat Edmondson. It's on her new album called Way Down Low, and she is performing on Sunday, May 6th, at Public Assembly in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and then on Monday beginning a residency at Zierzamine here in New York, three Mondays, the 7th, 14th, and 21st. But she and the band are here in the Soundcheck studio. This song is called Lucky.
Happiness feels like this, your heart upon your sleeve. There's a place in time and space where we can all be free. So meet me at the rainbow's end. We don't even have to pretend that we know what it is we're looking for. We're looking for. Life is just a dream. Lucky you. Lucky, lucky me. Life is just a dream. Lucky you, lucky, lucky me. Where I want to be. So cast your troubles into the sky. They can be the stars in our eyes, and we can count them all another day. From far away, life is just a dream. Lucky you, lucky, lucky me. Life is just a dream. Lucky, lucky me.
That is Kat Edmondson and her band with a live performance of Lucky, which appears on her new album, Way Down Low. And, Al, if you're able to switch guitars real fast, Kat, why don't
we just go
into your third song, which is called Hopelessly Blue. Again, the album Way Down Low, Kat Edmondson and the band live on Soundcheck.
You good?
Yeah.
Here we go.
I didn't think the day we met would be a day that I'd regret. Someone like you could make me so hopelessly blue. And now that you have gone away, I tell myself like smoke rings in the air. Are you happy now? Are you happy now? Don't you care? Hopeless is as hopeless does.
Once again, singer and songwriter Kat Edmondson. Her song, Hopelessly Blue, live performance from the band here in our Soundcheck studio, but you can also find it on her new album called Way Down Low. She's at Public Assembly in Williamsburg, Brooklyn this Sunday, and then beginning a series of Monday nights at Zierzeman here in New York, Monday, May 7th, 14th, and 21st. Kat, great to see you again. Thanks for coming in and playing for us today.
Thanks, John.
That's going to do it for Soundcheck today. Tomorrow on the show, our series on dance crazes continues with a look at the African-American roots of popular social dances. Also, the history of the jitterbug. We'll speak with Chris Calloway Brooks, band leader and grandson of Cab Calloway. Plus, a live performance from a band that blends klezmer, hip-hop, and funk called Abraham Inc. Our technical director is Irene Trudell, our engineer today, Paul Schneider, the program produced by Katie Bishop and Greta Cohn. Our senior producer is Joel Meyer. We had help today from Amy Pearl and Ellen Walkington. I'm John Schaefer. Be with us again tomorrow for another Soundcheck.
I just wasn't made for these times.